This is a Rabble Podcast Network show.
Rabble.ca.
Welcome, you're listening to The Green Majority here on CIUT 89.5 FM, possibly one of our wonderful and very appreciated community radio partners, international radio partners now as well, and as well Rabble.ca, who's recently joined our team of affiliates. We're going to be talking about a whole bunch of news today, actually a whole bunch of stuff, and we're going to kind of shotgun the first section, because there's a lot of headlines and we want to sort of weave a narrative of that. So Brenna Owen and M.A. Ma are going to join us in just a minute and run through some of this week's top headlines. Stefan and I have prepared I've prepared, and Stefan's going to play pundit as I read out some news. In the second section, we're going to talk a little bit about the relationship between major corporations and centers of power. So what is the relationship between major corporations and governments? World round, we'll give some American examples, we'll give some Canadian examples. What's important is the relationship. So we'll talk a little bit about that. Some relationship talk on the show today, Stefan.
Excellent.
And then in the final section, I have a wonderful interview for you as well. We've lined up Fiona Rayer, who is one of the filmmakers behind the film Fractured Land. It's going to be playing this year at the Water Docks Film Festival. I'll give some more information about the film as well later when we talk to Fiona. But essentially, this is about a First Nations Canadian named Celeb Ban. He's a Dene, I believe I'm pronouncing that correctly.
Yeah, Caleb.
Yes, Caleb. Yeah. Yes, who is a First Nations person who, in an attempt to defend his land and finding that what he was trying was not working to protect the health and safety of himself and others in his community, went on to get a law degree and is now a very prominent sort of frontline activist. The film is about him and the conflict in his community, because not all of his community members agree about these issues. So it's a fascinating film. We're going to learn more about it from Fiona later in the program as well, and we'll let you know if you're in the Toronto area where you'll be able to go and see it live at the Water Docks Film Festival, and then where you'll be able to find it later as well, as I'm sure it will be found elsewhere. But without further ado, I'm going to just pass it over now to M.A. Ma and Brent Owen, who are going to tell us a little bit about this week's top news. Take it away.
Thanks, Darren. We're going to start off the news with a follow-up story, actually, that we highlighted last week. So you'll probably recall that there was a lot of fanfare around the state visit by Justin Trudeau to the U.S., and he was hosted by the Obamas. And one of the major outcomes of that visit was actually a U.S.-Canada joint statement on climate, energy, and Arctic leadership. So this week, the full text of the statement has been released. And as we highlighted last week, one of the most significant things in the statement is this commitment to reducing methane. So actually setting a target around methane's emissions of reducing them by 40 to 45% below 2012 levels by 2025. And there is a full recognition in the statement that these are coming from the oil and gas sector, and that needs to be addressed. There's also been an acknowledgement of, as well, around agricultural emissions. So, Brenna, what do you make of the inclusion, explicit inclusion of these sectors in this statement? Do you see that as a step forward from where we were before?
Yeah, I mean, I think anything that's a hard commitment is obviously great. Methane is really significant. Immediately, as soon as I saw the headline, Trudeau vows to clamp down on methane emissions, though, I didn't think about the oil and gas industry. I thought about the vast amounts of methane that are being released into the atmosphere as Arctic permafrost melts. So, I mean, if we're going to stop that methane release, we're going to need to get more serious about cutting emissions that aren't just methane from the oil and gas industry. And it also kind of reminded me of, to be honest, in a way, maybe this is just it's probably my cynicism having been to the last three COP agreements, but like how the Harper government took like a sector by sector approach. And then within the oil and gas sector, you know, we had Harper saying it would be crazy to regulate emissions, but then he would pick out like very specific little things to regulate and like really boost those in the media. So yes, the federal government will impose methane emissions from the oil and gas industry specifically, like, that's great. But, you know, we're also talking about pipelines. We're talking about the recognition of free, prior, informed consent. So, you know, I think it's good to have a hard commitment, but I would like to see more.
Yes, and it's interesting because you said you didn't immediately make that link. So fracking does generate a lot of methane emissions, and Canada and the U.S. are in the top five emitters from the oil and gas sector, the U.S. being number two and Canada being number four. So I feel like at least this sort of brings this out into the light in terms of acknowledging the role of both countries in generating those emissions. The other parts, I believe, that are significant of the statement, so there's a part about, you know, collective contributions to cleaner energy and you know, generating that as part of our shared grid with the U.S. But something I want to highlight, because it links very much to the other articles that we're going to talk about and are posted on the Green Majority website, is the inclusion of the Arctic and Arctic conservation in this part of the statement. So you've made the link to methane emissions being very much a threat to the Arctic, and the Arctic obviously being very key in global temperature. So we're going to unpack that a little bit, but what I'd like to just draw our attention to for the moment is that they have acknowledged that Arctic biodiversity, conserving that, and taking measures really to look at industry around the Arctic and some regulation of that and building a sustainable Arctic economy, whilst also acknowledging the role of indigenous science and traditional knowledge, need to be all part of this picture.
I mean, yeah, like, I think that we talk a lot about biodiversity in the Arctic, and, like, that's great. You know, the polar bear has been, like, lauded, the kind of symbol of Arctic conservation. I think that's wonderful to preserve, like, sea life and all animals in the Arctic, because they're critical to the way of life and to food security for indigenous communities, Inuit communities. So, like, I would just like to see more language around sovereignty for Inuit communities and the fact that permafrost melt means infrastructure is literally crumbling in the Arctic. Like, it's not just about preserving this biosphere. It's about people's actual lives. Like, we've all heard about food prices in the north. And one of the reasons is because sea ice melts. It means people can't hunt seals anymore. And that's, like, one of the staple foods of Inuit communities. So, yeah, I was happy to see as well that there's in The Guardian, there's going to be an Arctic research vessel spending an entire year studying sea ice decline. I think that's wonderful because it'll contribute to the body of science that is, frankly, we already have. But I think it's great. And hopefully, you know, this might go a little bit further to people actually getting on board and serious about cutting emissions, because that's where we see temperature rise. At first, like, it's in the Arctic and in the Antarctic, like, it's a global thermometer. So,
yeah, I just want to jump in for half a second.
Okay, I'm stealing Darren's mic. Huzzah! just because specifically on the Arctic, the specific thing about that is, it's at least nice to see a change in understanding between how Harper understood Arctic security, mm-hmm. And sort of that shift back. Because there was one of the most impactful conversations I was a part of a couple years ago was this lecture given about the differences. So a researcher here at University of Toronto had done research on how Arctic communities saw what they understood as Arctic security, and how Harper described Arctic security. And Harper was sort of very much Arctic security. Harper was, we need to actually, like, basically militarize the Arctic to stake out our claim. Whereas on the flip side, you know, people in the community were like, no, I see the ice receding every summer. I need this land. And so it's at least positive for me to see that shift back towards maybe actually interacting with Arctic security as if it was that kind of, yeah, in the same, like, at least the government maybe is now aligning itself with how the communities see Arctic security, and at least a little more, right? You know, but there's still obviously a long way to go. You know, we don't have a real climate target yet, but it's at least I'm glad that our conversation about Arctic things are not the other way.
Yeah, I mean, Harper was definitely kind of using the fact that people live in the Arctic as a means to stake claim. So I think it's kind of emblematic of our Canadian identity that most, like the vast majority of Canadians live so close to the American border, but we pride ourselves on being true North, strong and free, and we the North. So that's kind of one of the great ironies, right?
Yeah, and we really need to acknowledge that this is an issue that's very multidimensional. So we need to look at the impact of climate change on Arctic communities and all this drive. We were talking a bit about this last time, this sort of contradiction potentially between state ambitions around claiming Arctic resources and then this line about conservation. And then there's the zoom out picture, which is really looking at the role of the Arctic and, you know, and the threats around, you know, melting permafrost and the impact on global average temperature. I mean, the Arctic is a cooling engine in our global environment. And this is a very significant thing to study when we talk about this vessel that's going to do a year's worth of studying on ice patterns. And this kind of scientific work needs to be directly linked to the decisions that governments are making.
Yeah, the thing I always I laugh about when I think about that sort of thing is, you know, it's... It's the attitude of so many people I'm assuming not most of our listeners, but the attitude of many people, unfortunately, with lots of positions of power that, you know, when they see, say there's a devastating drought or whatever it is, a windstorm in a forested area gets cleared, and their reaction is not, oh no, we've lost this environmental resource that was providing environmental services for us, has an inherent value, blah, 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 down the list of things. They just say, oh, great, now we don't have to spend money to cut them down to build condos. And that's the sort of attitude that I see a lot with the Arctic. And I wanted to come back to something Brenna just said really quickly as my only other comment, I think, on this for the time being. Was the idea of the polar bear and the iconic polar bear. And I was thinking about when you said that because, you know, for so many people, I think that was a very good visual representation. Mm-hmm. I think giving people a key is good. But my cynicism also goes in the media. My brain is that anytime anybody, and it's an argument, it's not a good argument or a bad argument in the sense that, it should or shouldn't be used. But I think it's a bad argument for convincing the people that are the most needing to be convinced. And the reason is as soon as you make it about an animal, it's very, very, very easy for them to rationalize and say, okay, well, yeah, I don't have a grudge against polar bears. I don't think we should wipe them out just for no reason. But if it comes down to me having a job versus a polar bear, what are you saying? The polar bear is more important than me? It makes that real easy for them. And so I always hesitate, although I'm not against making those references. And I think it did capture the imagination of a lot of people on a certain segment of the population. I think it also was at best meaningless and at worst actually provided an excuse to rationalize for another segment of the population. So I don't have advice about to use or to not to use those types of images. I just think that they're not universally applicable and they're occasionally double-edged swords.
So I just want to come back to this agreement again, and part of that agreement is, or the statement is, to take a science-based approach to oil and gas, and one can really question the integrity of these kinds of statements because they sometimes contradict what's actually happening in terms of the things that government's promoting. But I think it's really important to note that we've seen a significant victory actually transpire this week, and this is another article that's going to be posted, which is that there's actually been a decision taken by the Obama administration to ban Atlantic seaboard drilling. This is a reversal of a previous position. So a lot of communities and towns mobilized against exploratory oil and gas drilling in the Atlantic. They were concerned about another spill happening. And as a result, we've seen a reversal in course, which I believe is very positive. So I think, you know, when we approach these kind of statements with a lot of skepticism, but we also need to note when there's been a major achievement, which really I think we can say came a lot from grassroots mobilization and people in communities making that personal connection to saying, you know, if there are spills like the one that's happened previously, these are going to impact communities. These are going to not only impact human beings, but also wildlife around the coast.
Yeah, it's interesting just since Obama is kind of coming to the end of his tenure, like, you know, how that's going to play out in terms of community resistance being successful in Canada, like to things like Energy East, the Line 9. I think in Canada we're seeing a lot of like court a lot of action in the courts as opposed to like community resistance being listened to. But I mean, I hope that's going to change, and that's the work that I do. So,
and speaking of double-edged swords, I think that's the double-edged sword of Canadian quote unquote politeness as well. I wouldn't want to be seen to be a disturber of the peace. I'll, you know, quietly wait for someone to sue in court and take the official channels. And I think that, as I said, there's a double-edged sword to that too. We're a bit complacent. We don't like to cause a fuss most of the time, and I think sometimes there is a good reason to cause a fuss. Not that I'm advocating any specific action, to be clear.
Yeah, and one area that where a fuss is being raised on his position actually in the U.S. is this contradiction with, you know, the approach that he's taking to some of these other issues and his championing of the TPP. So various environmental groups have flagged this up as an apparent contradiction, and we're really looking at you know, the advancing of a trade agreement that, while it does have some environmental protections within it, and the Obama administration has really lauded it for these things, that there are stronger clauses that may potentially override those environmental protections. And I just want to mention that the Canadian Center for Policy Alternatives has actually released a report on this very topic, and you can also find this on our website, so do check that out. So there's a lot of, as Brent has highlighted, there's a lot that's happening as Obama starts to prepare for his exit, and he wants to leave a good environmental legacy. But on the other hand, things continue to happen which may undermine this, and some of this is actually coming from his own administration.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and what's interesting about this course is trying to watch Obama sort of navigate the climate change file, we'll call it, over his 8 years. There's an excellent question in a conversation I saw recently on Twitter about whether or not he could have successfully passed climate change if he had prioritized it over health care. And what's interesting was, even, you know, Dave Roberts, who's one of at least my favorite environmental writers in the United States, believed no. He thought that climate change actually would have been harder to pass than healthcare. And healthcare is something that we've been trying to pass for, what, 20, 30, 40 years. And the idea that sort of climate change he actually firmly believed that it was actually more difficult to have strong climate change policy passed than healthcare passed is astounding, and also shows the amount of the amount of distance there still is to go.
Yeah, absolutely. And
sorry, if I can just make a quick comment about what Stefan said. It was just that I find that I can agree and disagree with that at the same time for two completely different reasons. I'll just throw those reasons out there. The reason I disagree is because it is unimaginable that there could, like, what more opposition could you give something? The Republicans in the U.S. broke every conceivable record when it came to obstructionism. So when we're talking about harder, what do you mean by that? Because I'm not sure more obstruction or more opposition could have been generated on any issue ever. They literally broke the record. They tried to prevent Obamacare something like 60 times in the courts. Like, basically render it, we lost the fight in politics, so we're going to try and make this obsolete in the courts. I think the previous record was something like 4, and they went to something like 60. I'm guessing those numbers from memory. On the other hand, the argument could be made that, at least with Obamacare, there a whole bunch of really big health corporations got – the government made a law requiring people to be customers of theirs. And so at least a bunch of the healthcare companies were like, this might actually not be that bad. So that in that context, I could see it. So there's two sides.
The thing about the real actual issue was Democrats from coal states. You know, West Virginia Democrats are never, you know, more than happy to give you health care. We'll fight you to the death on climate regulation.
Yeah, we could have a whole show about that. We'll leave it there.
You could. But this also brings up an important point, which is, because this president is exiting, everything that's been released in the statement is at risk. Now, Obama's tried to move things through his executive powers, so not having to go through the houses of government and put in measures. But he's already being called out by some of the parties that be on those actions, saying that they're outside the scope of his power. Again, this is a lengthy discussion on how the American political system works. But all this is to highlight that this is tenuous at best in terms of being able to follow through on these from a two-state perspective. The other thing I just want to throw in the mix is the foreign policy dimension. Now, we had spoken last time about this case with the Honduran environmental activist, Berta Cáceres, who had been murdered. And I raised the point that the Honduran government had actually been supported by the U.S. government. So that adds a layer of complexity. I also want to take this opportunity to retract something I said, because I accidentally, when talking about the Honduran government and the relationship to the U.S., I'd accidentally said Guatemala. So I apologize to the people of Guatemala and for the mischaracterization of that. But this just brings me to our last story before we go to the break, which is a very, very sad story, which is to report on another Honduran activist and colleague of Berta Cáceres, Nelson Garcia, I believe is his name, who has also been murdered this week. He belonged to the same organization that she did and was advocating on the same rights. And there was earlier in the day before he was murdered, there was, you know, a protest around an indigenous community being displaced. So we're seeing a very, very concerning pattern happening here. There are statistics that show that in Honduras, it's one of the most risky parts of the world to be an environmental activist. We've seen, I think, 101 people die over a fairly short period. So we just wanted to report on that follow-up story from last week.
All right. I think that's about perfect time. Thank you, Emma and Brenna and Stefan, for your comments. I'm, of course, your host, Darren Kaster, and we're going to go to our first music break here. But just before we go to our today's technician, Alex, to find out what that music break is going to be, I'm going to just make two quick announcements. One of them was to remind folks that if you have a comment about anything that we'd like to talk about, you are, of course, welcome to email us. But you can also leave a voicemail, and it can be something about we talked about, something and we didn't, as long as it's something that has to do with the environment. And unfortunately, we had to not play a couple of people that called in because they called in just to promote their own websites, and we don't do that. So if you have a comment about an environment issue you would like us to talk about or something you'd like to say, you can call 1-877-736-3921. And if you're listening on radio, not a podcast, you can't wind that back. You can just go to greenmajority.ca/contact us. The second announcement before we go to that is that, Stefan, did you know that April 22nd is Earth Day?
I did not.
Did you know what else is on April 22nd of this year?
Our 500th episode.
You're darn right. Our 500th episode. So we don't, of course, have any money, so we're not throwing a gigantic party, but we are going to have a small shindig and enjoy a few beverages together. So if you'd like to meet the team, meets the cast of the show, some previous volunteers as well. Kevin Farmer has already confirmed his attendance. For those of you that miss Kevin, you can meet him live and buy him a beer as well. So that'll be April 22nd of this year. We are doing tickets, just very, very moderately priced tickets as well, just to cover some of the basic costs. But if there's anyone who would like to attend for which the cost is prohibitive, just contact me and let me know, and we'd rather have you than not. We will also, I'm not going to do it this week because we're tight on time, but before we get to that event, I am also going to auction off a couple of those tickets as well. So it's in Toronto. If you're in Toronto on April 22nd, we would love to come and meet you. That would be fabulous. So without further ado, Alex, who's also going to be there?
I will be there, Darren. And I'm excited to see Kevin again, too. So today we're going to hear from a band called Whoopso. They're from London, Ontario. They are described as psych, post-metal, sludge, and with elements of folk. And I had the privilege of playing with this band recently at a show in Sarnia. And they blew my mind. So I'm going to hopefully blow everyone's mind by playing them right now. Here's Whoopso with a song called Jerry.
We're coming back in. You're listening to The Green Majority here on CIUT 89.5 FM, one of our wonderful radio community partners now internationally as well as the podcast and rabble.ca. If you're listening on the podcast, though, that's the only place to hear our bonus show. And we're going to hear from Sabina, who runs the bonus show, which is not produced on air, but is on the podcast version found on our site. You will be able to hear from Sabina herself at the end of this segment, preview what today's discussion will be. We actually got into a pretty lively discussion last week. We're trying to keep it close to about 10 minutes, the bonus show, because it's, you know, it's already an hour long show, but man, we just keep having so much to say. It's it's there. So if you're not sick of us during the regular show, check out the podcast as well. You hear the extended show. I'm, of course, your main host, Darren Kaster, and Stefan is going to help me through this next session a little bit. So this was all being pulled from some recent news. Most of it was from this week. I think one was like technically last week's, you know, but whatever. But just we're sort of drawing a narrative here. So I'm going to introduce a few news stories really quickly, and then we're going to draw a narrative between them because that's what we do. So one of the pieces, there's a pair of pieces that are coming out that came out yesterday and today from National Observer. Mike D'Souza, who is a longtime excellent journalist who well, I don't believe at any time in his career was like officially the environment correspondent. Did work for a variety of Canadian news agencies, and frequently wrote about climate and environment related topics. He has since left the major corporate media and has joined the National/Vancouver Observer team, and we could not be more happy because now he has even more legs to run with on these stories, and he's been doing some great work. And he's you know, one of those journalists that does the really hard work of sitting around and waiting for people to answer access to information requests, but when he gets the back, boy, is there a story to tell. So we're going to skim through some of this real quick, and I'll get to it in a minute. So one of the things that Mike D'Souza pointed discovered here was that there's a number of reports that were being done by the NEB, the National Energy Board, which of course is reviewing all these under highly controversial, to put it most politely and most generously, I think, pipelines throughout Canada. And what the what it reveals, I may stick in a couple key quotes here that are pulled directly from these emails as well. Later, but just to sort of overview it for now, essentially what the articles are outlining, and I do suggest you read them, is, you know, these are copies of emails, copies of text, so it's not sort of Mike making, you know, accusations or whatnot. These are just like, hey, this is an email that was sent. This doesn't seem right. Was exposing an extremely cozy, like, hey, can I meet you for coffee? I want to give you a heads up about this report we're going to release, and I don't want you guys to get too upset. So let's have a coffee and talk about it. And by the way, if you'd like me to change anything in that report, just go ahead and let me know, and we'll probably do it, sort of relationship. Yeah. I know that was a long title, but so we'll get into some of the details. So I'm gonna pull together a few disparate stories, and then we'll talk about how they make sense in 1 second. So I'll run through two more, and then we'll go to you, Stefan, for comment. So one of the other stories that may not seem immediately related, unless you're sort of on the same headspace I am. Of course, we talked a little bit about the ongoing Flint water crisis this last week. We had Rick Snyder in a congressional hearing about the water crisis, essentially himself, he's the governor of Michigan, flinging things at the EPA and saying this is all the EPA's fault, who the administrator of which has a unfortunate last name of McCarthy. So we'll just try not to get distracted by that. Different McCarthy. But essentially what it comes down to is he's saying, well, you know, and you know how Republicans love when the federal government goes into states' rights issues and tells states what to do. He's essentially, his excuse was, well, hey, you didn't override me and tell me what to do, so it's your fault, which sounds entirely consistent with your average conservative, especially American Republican right-wing talking points of states' rights. What it looks at, again, is that a situation where Rick Snyder gave a whole bunch of millions and millions and millions of dollars in tax breaks to his corporate buddies to promote business interests, quote unquote, which resulted in them having a shortfall, which resulted in them being forced to change water sources, which resulted in most of their citizens being poisoned. And then knowing about it for sure, absolutely demonstrated, proven he knew about it, and not saying anything about it for a year. So we'll move on to one more thing, and then we'll go to Stefan to see if Stefan can see where I'm going with this. There's another, again, very common story. You can probably pick at random day of the week where you'll find a story at an alternative news source about this stuff, which is simply reporting on things which are demonstrably and factually true. They're not claims. They're demonstrable facts, but the major networks seem to just And that is, of course, you know, tons of speeches about Bernie Sanders. We've had all sorts of moderators of the American debates between Hillary Clinton and Bernie Sanders, where Hillary Clinton is being asked things either in interview or in debates like, what's your favorite color? Did you have a puppy when you were growing up? And then only to turn to Bernie Sanders and say, socialist, socialist, socialist. How are you not just like those genocidal communist companies, blah, 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 you know, countries and blah, 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 blah. And just absolutely one-sided. Now, the thread here that I'm sure you're figuring out by now that I'm getting to is just the absolute amount of BS that happens. There's a whole bunch of corporate influence. They get influence into our politics. They get influence into the news. They get influence in how things are done. We have supposed regulators in Canada asking permission from TransCanada. May I publish this report, please, sir? And TransCanada coming back and say, well, if you must, but we're going to ask you for these 38 changes. That's not a number I'm making up. That's in Mike D'Souza's article. And them going back and saying, all right, well, here's 38 changes we'd like you to make to this report that removes words like rupture. You know, not language, not choice of words. We want you to remove words that sound scary because they might make us look bad. So we're going to take out words like rupture and broke and spill and, you know, other technical definition words of things that happen. But of course, there's no influence here. There's no controversy because, of course, the corporate media is here to protect us, Stefan. And they're here to report on the news, unless, of course, all of their ad revenue comes from these corporations, which are getting all of these breaks, and they sit at the same fancy dinner tables and go to the same fancy dinners and hang out at all the same fancy clubs. Would, of course, not in any way influence their opinion and in what sorts of decisions they make. So see if you can guess now, Stefan, where am I going with this?
I'm going to take the slightly more centrist thought process on this, which really just has to do with sort of what I referenced last week, which is the sort of idea of invisible power. And the difficulty that we sort of see consistently facing the sort of – because what you just said – which I know if in an hour-long conversation you could generally sort of go back and point out to would sound in would it was unpalatable to probably 80% of the population. The idea that everyone sort of accepts that generally there's a level of distrust with large multinational corporations right now, but at the same time there's only some of them and there's a conversation going on there as well. And to some extent people also just sort of just want things to keep. They want to keep things just working to some as well. But what's interesting about the three examples you chose all have this sort of interesting little piece of what invisible power really looks like. And so to start with Michael Souza's article, the regulator versus regulatee connection is everywhere. It's not just in oil and gas. It's everywhere. And some of the most interesting things are sort of when you look at what banking regulation tries to do, because so often you read these articles about like how the bank regulator. All of their colleagues are the people in the bank because they are sent into the bank to be the regulator, but they're working in the bank. And in some sense, like, how can you be an objective regulator if you're working inside the bank and all of your colleagues that you see every single day are the people who work at the bank? In the same way that it's the same reason why people are suspicious of special investigation units and police forces because mm-hmm. the same thing. It's this.
Another perfect example would be all the unarmed black men who have been shot, and then the cops don't get charged because all the same prosecutors are all the same people that work every single day with all the same cops. Well, right? That's not the only factor. But that's one really big factor.
And actually, you saw that actually quite recently in the two different prosecutors actually just lost their jobs because they're elected, and two major prosecutors lost their jobs in Ohio, at least one in Ohio for sure, for failing to be seen as objective in those kind of cases. But I think it's this centralized tension between regulator and regulated, where the people who are being regulated. Because you work so connected, it's so hard to not be captured to some extent. And I think in one of the D'Souza articles, he mentions a famous quote or sort of a version of a famous quote from the 1920s, which is basically that justice must not only happen, it must appear to be happening. And that really struck me because that's so – like people – the defense of the NEB would constantly just be like, look, we have to, we're working together. We really care about this sort of thing. But I think the importance of the reason why no one trusts the NEB is because we don't actually trust that it's doing what it says and it's doing, right? And this idea that even if all of these coffee talks were totally normal and were totally a part of, probably above board, you have to pay attention to that. You have to make justice seem like it's happening or you lose public trust. And the only value of government is public trust, which segues perfectly into the second one you mentioned.
Yeah, so let's go to one of the specific quotes from that piece. Okay, so what are we talking about? So what are they talking about at coffee, right? Well, we know a little bit about what they're talking about at coffee because Mike D'Souza dug up some of the reply emails that were sort of like follow-ups from these discussions. And one of the things that would happen was there was 36 changes recommended by TransCanada to the National Energy Board. National Energy Board accepted all but two. Now, a few of these are typos, grammatical mistakes, and corrected errors. Most of the changes, however, are removing embarrassing language. For instance, deleting of such words as rupture and blowdown, which is a technical word used by technical people in the field to describe a very specific situation. These words are removed, so into the word rupture was removed, and instead they would refer to the repair, right? So it's kind of like saying instead of I got the flu and I got sick, it was saying, well, I took medication a few weeks ago. Okay, if you want to say that's not intentionally deceitful, I guess I can't prove it, but come on, especially when you do it, when almost every single change you've requested is to remove language you don't like, and then you say that the reason you want it changed is because you don't like the sound of the language. Like, they literally, in the email, you again, read it for yourself if you want, they're literally saying, we're concerned about how this will make us look, so can you please use different language? And I think that, and I'm not sort of disagreeing with what Stefan's saying, I'm just putting an emphasis on the point that this isn't just a situation of it looking bad. There are, in fact, things happening which, to my sensibilities, I would call corruption.
Well, I think you can sort of see this, like, this difficulty of regulation extends, and difficulty of sort of when with this combination extends into the sort of the Flint water crisis. This gets to the second point, which is that when you have this distrust of public institutions, that's when you get the EPA being in front of Congress, right? Because enough people believe the EPA. Like, what's fascinating with the EPA in this scenario is that it's the right wing is going to swing it as governments are incompetent rather than a poorly funded regulator cannot regulate.
Something's broken, so get rid of it.
Well, exactly.
That's their whole thing.
And so it's such an interesting. It's funny when these sort of not funny, but sort of depressing when these things happen. You can see how both sides are going to swing it, right? Mm. And to go back to invisible power. Sorry. When you look at sort of like who got the tax breaks and then who got hurt. There's no direct line. This is probably as close as you're going to get to. It's a pretty direct line. It's like, we gave tax breaks, we could not afford it, we did it. But you see that everywhere with conservative governments. You know, why did Harper reduce so much of our environmental regulations? Well, we can no longer afford it because he cut the GST. And it's this sort of goal of sapping government from its power by cutting its actual money into it, and then that ends up hurting people who the most vulnerable. But then ends up this conversation be like, oh, but we have to let it go. We have to let it go. We have to ignore it. And Emmy wants to jump in.
Yeah, I just wanted to add something to this discussion that follows on our ongoing thread about the Trans-Pacific Partnership Agreement, or the TPP. So there's sort of two dimensions, there are many, but there are two dimensions that are particularly important. There's sort of willful corrupt practices, right? And then there's structural problems that enable corrupt practices. So one of the ongoing criticisms of the TPP is in the ISDS, or the Investor State Dispute Settlement Mechanism, is that you have this secretive tribunal that's made up of adjudicators, and there's the potential for many of these adjudicators to also be practicing investment law or corporate law with the same companies that bring their cases to bear through this type of mechanism. There's also an inherent interest built in for adjudicators that are paid per case or for their time on cases to want to rule in favor of these cases so that they get more business. So I'm just bringing this into this discussion because I think it also illustrates the point that both of you are making around, us adopting structures that are going to allow for this kind of behavior or incentivize this kind of behavior to happen. And, willful corruption is one thing, but when we, in terms of our governments, adopt structures legally that permit this and, in fact, encourage this to happen, then we need to really raise the alarm about that.
Yeah, and I think that's if there's a takeaway from this conversation, I think it's that there's a growing disconnect between the public trust and institutions of all natures. To loop in your last sort of point about corporate media. Everyone goes on about how there's no Walter Cronkite anymore, and I'm too young to actually remember Walter Cronkite, but I understand that, like, he was the kind of person who'd go on air and just sort of what he said was like, this is gospel to some extent. He's bringing me the truth, and you actually can trust him inherently because that was his job. He was giving you the news. And I think we've now seen in all facets, within government, within corporatocracies, within sort of both policy, both elected government and as NEB goes in bureaucracy, this sort of lack of public trust in any of these major institutions. And I think that's what you're seeing with this sort of reaction, whether it be Jeremy Corbyn in the UK or Sanders, and to honestly some extent Trump, and also I think why the NDP sort of failed to garner, the NDP could have run the Jeremy Corbyn type campaign in the last election, decided to run to center, and they lost, but that's beside the point. But I think think there's this. I think what we're really seeing is this groundswell of lack of trust within all of these large institutions, and it's from this idea that it's not good enough to just say you're doing it. People have to believe you. Like, justice has to feel like it's happening. Media has to feel like it's unbiased. And when you can see these things about, like, everyone knows the media is covering Trump because he brings ratings.
They can't not cover him, or they will literally go out of business. If they don't cover him and cover somebody else, they will not get those views. Right. They literally have no choice under the system that we have.
Well, and that's the argument, right? And it's this, yeah. And it's this fascinating difficulty between these three different institutions and more, I think. And so, like, if there's one thing, it's we got to find a way to bring public trust back into these institutions. And how we do that, I think, is largely by getting them to sort of realize that they have to start up. They have to up their game to some extent to prove to us, the public, that they really are just and fair and not biased.
All right, so we'll have to leave it there for that. Unfortunately, we'll be back in a minute to talk to Fiona Rayer, who's going to talk to us about the documentary film Fractured Land. As far as a final wrap-up comment on that, the phrase from the U.S., the wall of separation, which is used to talk about the secular nature of the American government, I think there should be a wall of separation between the people and the government and corporations and their shareholders. I think we should have each of those two groups on different sides and not corporations, their shareholders, and the government on one side with just the people on the other. Sabina's going to tell us right now, jumping in as well, what we're going to be hearing on the bonus show today. If you are listening to the podcast, what is our topic going to be today, Sabina?
So today on the bonus show, I'll be talking about the effect of neonicotinoid pesticides on the different bee species, as well as the role of effective communication of scientific data in order to create new agricultural products that don't destroy our environment.
Thank you very much, Sabina. And Alex now is going to tell us what our second and final music break is going to be.
Thanks, Darren. So we're going to hear from a band called The Lonely Parade from Peterborough, and they're in town March 18th, which happens to be tonight, playing at the Monarch Tavern in Toronto. So, yeah, this is a song called Girl by The Lonely Parade.
All right, and welcome back. You're listening to The Green Majority here on CIUT 89.5, and I regret to inform you that due to a severe technical error, I would like to point out that it's not ours, but unfortunately it's a technical error beyond our control has prevented us from speaking to Fiona today. Unfortunately, we just found out, we tried for a minute there, Alex tried his best to resolve the issue. It is unresolvable, so I do apologize. So I will just let you know that on March 22nd, if you're interested in seeing this film, it has already been around for a little while, but I think everybody in the studio but me has seen it, and they all say it's absolutely fantastic. I was very excited to talk to Fiona, but we'll maybe try and get her back on another show to talk about it, because it will be around and viewable. If you're in the Toronto area, though, we do suggest that you check out the Toronto Water Docks Film Festival, which is starting. I didn't make a note of that date. So I think it's just the day before. So around March 20th, you can check the website greenmajority.ca for listing on that as well. And then on the 22nd at 7 p.m., you'll be able to see Fractured Land. We'll post a link to the preview again, and then apologies. Unfortunately, it'd be completely beyond our control to lose that. So we've got a few minutes here, which is good, because we were like foaming at the mouth almost with things to still say about that previous topic. So let me jump right back in, because I actually missed one of the articles, and I'll just throw this out in general. Maybe if Brenna has anything to say, because she's remained mostly silent for the middle, we'll give you right of first refusal for commenting on this. So one of the other things that I like to go, because I'm apparently in an incredibly sarcastic mood today, as opposed to feisty, I'm sarcastic. There's an important difference.
Sarcastic Wheaties? Sarcastic Fruit Loops?
Maybe Sarcastic Fruit Loops. Sarcastaloops.
Sarcastaloops. There we go.
Would that be so corporate, guys? Naming brands, please?
Okay. 100% organic, nature's best Sarcastaloops. Made entirely of non-GMO. Okay. Well, that's run its course.
There we go.
So the final news item today that I was hoping to get to, and then we didn't, and then now it looks like we have time for, was an article also posted by the National Observer, so big shout out to them for doing some excellent journalism, was the oil and gas groups asking for federal funds to clean up inactive wells. And the reason why I think this is important is because it comes back to the entire national conversation we keep having about renewable energy and about positions that the Liberal government takes, which is only a marketing difference as far as I'm concerned. Okay, not entirely, but I'm, as I said, sarcastic Wheaties today. Is arguably not super different than the Harper's position, outside of how they're branding it, which is that we need the oil sands and, hey, what can we do? Our hands are tied. You know, we're talking about an industry that, well, what are the arguments for? Well, it's a huge resource, and we can use that money to do lots of good things. Keep people employed is great, and we can use that money to invest in the environment. I don't buy it, but let's say that's one of the arguments for now. The other argument, of course, is that this is incredible. Well, that's one of them, is it's incredibly profitable and we can use this money for stuff. I will spare going into my obvious examples of other things that everyone would agree are not good but could be financial beneficial slavery. So that argument doesn't fly with me on its face, just because you can derive benefit from something by harming other people or by harming yourself in the future. I think that's a really poor argument. But the thing that comes back, well, you know, renewables, they're not ready. It's too expensive. Okay, well, why does oil and gas get billions of dollars in subsidies? Why does the public have to pay most of the costs when there's an oil spill? And finally, why should we pay oil and gas companies to clean up their own mess in the extremely rare situation where they're actually in a position where we can make them pay for it? Yeah. I did give Brent write a first review. So if you want to jump, Stefan's raring to go. Okay, we'll let Stefan jump in. Okay.
What I find fascinating about this is that it comes back to this. One of the big arguments for tar sands expansion or tar sands investment was that they would reclaim the land. That was a big thing. It was like, look, it'll be okay because all the land will be reclaimed at the end of it. We're going to come in, we're going to do this, and we'll reclaim the land. And that was a central part of the pitch. I think we acted like 2 years ago. We did a thing about how only 2% of all land had been reclaimed, something like that. What's fascinating about this now is now, to our surprise, they are being like, well, we can't afford to reclaim the land. Maybe you could do that now. It gets to a point where when you just want to like go back 10 years from now and be like, they're not going to do this. You know they're not going to do this. And to some extent, at what point is the government sort of just kicking the can down the road and accepting that, you know what, these corporations aren't actually going to pay to reclaim this land. They're not actually going to do what they're saying they're doing. But they'll make us money now, and we have to get elected in 4 years, and that will be someone else's problem.
So I did some hypothetical napkin math, Stefan. By hypothetical, I mean the napkin itself is hypothetical, but you know the expression. So they're asking for $500 million. And I'll just do a little comparison, then I think MA is getting ready to jump in here. So what I did a little back of the napkin math here was, $500 million. Let's say there's 250,000 oil sands employees. I didn't research that number. I made it up. It's probably too high. It might even be a little too low, but it's not going to be – if it's off, it's too high. So let's say there's 250,000 oil sands employees. So this would be, to me, the equivalent of having a child who – you asked nicely to clean the room and they said no, and then you offer them $2,000. That's the comparison there, unless my math is wrong. I think Stefan's checking my math.
I'm finding how many people are going to...
But so like what possible argument could you make? And like the only argument you could possibly make was, hey guys, our bad, by completely frontlining this industry at the behest of so others, you have made us so big in your economy that we are so big to fail that you have no choice but to support us through our hard times, because so many people will be out of work. And what we're saying, or at least what I'm saying, is exactly my point. We should never be in this situation in the first place. And by the way, how many of your executives have yachts? Lots of them. So you guys go ahead and sell your yachts that you earned by strip mining our country and poisoning millions of Canadians, and by kicking colluding with the Harper government to otherwise, you know, just basically take land from people and ignore all sorts of land treaty rights. And we could spend an hour listing all the things you guys have done. And how about you clean up your own damn mess out of pocket? And let me see you sell your yachts before you ask us for public money to clean up your mess, M.A.
I just wanted to maybe highlight the obvious point. You use the terminology around reclaiming the land. Well, some of it's not reclaimable. The impacts on the environment and the impacts on human health cannot be restored, and that obviously should have been part of the calculation before this industry has been supported to move ahead as it has. However, I just want to point out another case that's happening in the U.S. We often talk about Monsanto on this show, and the city of Portland, Oregon has decided to actually sue Monsanto on the basis of, and this is the headline of the article or part of it, favoring profits over ecological and human health. So they are taking Monsanto to court for activities that they've conducted in terms of releasing PCBs into the environment from 1935 onwards, willfully knowing that these have a detrimental effect on human health. So I like to highlight cases like that because it does show that cities, as the representatives of us, residents, citizens, whatever, are actually taking actions. Now, the action has already caused damage. The release of PCBs has already caused damage. So we don't want to be in a position where we're trying to address that post. However, it's still good that corporations be held to account.
Yeah. And well, like the thing for me is that like I don't understand why the public, I understand why it happens in reality. I don't understand why the public is in agreement or at the very best lackadaisical about the fact that there are obviously two sets of rules in this country and pretty much every country, which is that people who have lots of influence and power have a different set of rules than everybody else. And I'm not asking for, people will often phrase it, oh, the environmental, you're anti-industry, you're anti, all sorts of nonsense, completely unjustified and unbacked up claims about things that we think. All we're asking is that the same rules apply. You know, when we're talking about these reports that the NEB helped, was complicit with TransCanada in editing, when was the last time that the tax man asked you if you would like to comment and change any of the language in your tax forms? No, we just submit information. We don't get to go and have a meeting with them and say, I'd like to request these changes because this doesn't make me look very good. We don't get meetings. If you're saying, well, we need to talk to these people because they're the experts, that's what I've heard people say to me before. Well, we have to do it in partnership with industry because they're the ones that know all the information. Fine. Same with my taxes. I submit a tax form. Here's the information you're requesting. I give it to you. Then you go away and make an informed decision with experts about how much money I owe you. But that rule doesn't apply. And we could spend 10 shows going through all the different ways in which large organizations get different sets of rules. And what I'm saying is if you want to have your cake, you can't eat it too. You don't get to socialize the costs and privatize all the benefits, you know, which means when they have a good year, they go and all buy yachts. And when they have a bad year, they send us the bill. And I'm saying, screw that.
Yeah. So to jump in to to MA's point, one because I fact checked your number, and then we have 2 minutes, so we're almost off the air. So to MA's point first, the fast thing about PCBs is that they were a well known pesticide for quite some time, and now we're using neonicotinoids instead, which our bonus show is about. So let's talk about we solved one problem just with a new thing we haven't proved is toxic yet, even though it's banned in Europe. Point two, Darren, there's 100 in 2014. There were 133,000 employees upstream, so not downstream, so about upstream employees of the oil and gas sector. Which, if you then do the actual math, dividing that by 500 million, you get $3,759 dollars per person to pay for these uncapped wells. So those are the two last points that I have, and a throw to you to throw us off.
All right, so that's all the time we have for a reminder. If you'd like to come and have a beer with us or a non-alcoholic beverage if you're underage or don't drink, we would love to meet you. Just a short hangout from 6 to 9 on the 22nd of April at the Center for Social Innovation Annex location. Check the website for tickets. Tickets are very moderately priced just to help us cover some of the basic costs of throwing an event. And if you can't come because of the cost, contact us and I will give you a code because we'd rather see you than have your $6. So with that, we'll be right back with Sabina Hyseni, who I'm going to double check that I'm not mangling her last name in 1 second. And other than that, have a good Green Week, folks. And if you're listening to the podcast, we'll be right back for our bonus show. Thanks so much for listening to The Green Majority. Take care.